The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939. This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
The election is finally over. We do have an outcome. President-elect Biden will assume the oath of office on January 20th. And the stock market seems to be liking what it's seeing as stocks hit new record after record. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplav, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. And it's going to be our annual forecast issue where we take a look at the consensus and take a look at what the experts are saying about the economy and the stock market. You're going to be surprised, and especially some of these outside-the-box predictions are not so outrageous. That will be coming up. And our technician this week is Mish Schneider. She's managing director at Market Gauge, and she's very positive about the rally in stocks broadening out beyond these tech stocks that so dominated markets in 2020. All of that coming up, but first, Ryan Poplava with what moved the markets this week.
Wow, what a week we had to kick off the new year. Let's highlight some of the events here. A special election to determine the fate of Congress on Tuesday in Georgia that gave Democrats two more seats, tying the Republicans. Protesters storming the Capitol building to prevent the presidential election confirmation. Saudi Arabia cutting production another million barrels in February and March, and a jobs report that was lackluster. I'll get right to the gist of it all and give you my opinion on why the financial markets reacted the way they did. Let's first take a look at the special election, as well as a reminder about the Democratic win back in November with the House staying Democratic and a president, Democratic president, and how the market responded then. Just due to uncertainty, the stock market dipped leading up to the elections, but starting on election day, and as a result of news of a vaccine, confidence began to be restored. A split Congress with the Democratic president resulted in the assumption that more stimulus and spending was coming from fiscal policy, but that a more progressive agenda, for example, on taxation, would be difficult for Biden to get through Congress. As a result, the market surged. Fast forward to today, what does a 50-50 split Senate mean for the Democratic agenda as a result of the two-seat win in Georgia? It means a couple of things here. Number one, the Democrats and Biden will be able to hit the ground running on stimulus. Biden said on Wednesday, after Ossoff and Warnock won, "I have long said that the bipartisan COVID-19 relief bill passed in December was just a down payment. We need urgent action on what comes next." And earlier, Biden had promised Georgia voters $2,000 stimulus checks would go out the door immediately once he got in. It is now being reported Friday that Biden will propose a $3 trillion infrastructure plan. Secondly, the issue here is that unless the Democrats can find 60 votes to overcome a filibuster, it will likely be too difficult to pass some of the more progressive agenda of the Democratic Party, such as statehood for D.C. and Puerto Rico, more taxation, and immigration reform. So what does increased spending and little chance of taxation mean for the financial markets? It means big bucks, no whammies. The Russell 2000 Small Cap Index, primarily financials and domestic companies, outperformed this week up more than 5% as of this recording, as did stocks in general, did very well, all up more than 1%. And finally, the 10-year Treasury price fell enough to cause its yield to get through that long-term resistance we've been talking about at 1%, which last I looked was at 1.10%. The decline in the U.S. dollar has continued since the November elections, and gold has broken its August consolidation and is trending above both its 200-day long-term and its intermediate 50-day moving averages. The 1960s, which has been holding gold back short-term, is still relevant, but if Congress takes the spending course it plans, gold should hold its current trend higher. The storming of the Capitol building midweek did curb some of the enthusiasm of bulls. The S&P 500 was up 1.5% Wednesday before settling only up 0.6% at the close due to the protests. but with the event short-lived, Thursday's stocks closed at record highs. Let's shift to look at oil. There was news earlier in the week that Russia and Saudi Arabia were seeing eye to eye about OPEC holding production steady through February, which caused oil prices to rise. But at the end of the day, Saudi Arabia followed up with a production cut of 1 million barrels per day for February and March. West Texas crude contracts hit back above $50 a barrel for the first time since early 2000. And at the end of the week, Chevron got upgraded Friday to overweight from neutral at Piper Sandler. Finally, let's talk about the economic numbers this week. It's the beginning of the month. We get a lot of heavy-hitting numbers. The December employment report, which was the key on Friday, did disappoint. Payrolls declined by 140,000 versus expectations for 112,000 increase. That was partly offset by better December hourly earnings and an upward revision to November's job figures. But investors likely looked past the report on Friday on fiscal spending sentiment, but it shows things are still awful in the labor market. Continuing unemployment claims have been stubborn as well at around 5 million, down only 126,000 for December. The upside this week in the economic numbers came from manufacturing and non-manufacturing ISM reports for December, showing that they were better than expected. Manufacturing hit 60.7, nearly 10 basis points shy of the 2018 high. And services ISM rose to about 57.2 in December from 55.9. So nice increases in both, both showing some real big wins. I haven't talked about the trade deficit in a while, but it did widen quite a bit to $68.1 billion in November from $63.1 billion. So up about $5 billion, showing just really, what does that mean? Just an uptick in global trade overall, a very good sign in, of course, these COVID times, but also a catalyst for weakness in the dollar, which continues. That's it for an eventful week on Wall Street and for the country. Jim, back to you.
This week on FS Insider, we spoke about the geostrategic importance of China's digital yuan, which this week they rolled out their third experimentation, scaling it up to 100,000 Chinese citizens through a lottery format, giving free money to them with the newly launched central bank digital currency. Here's what Aditi Kumar, executive director at Harvard's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs, had to say on FS Insider this week.
It all comes down to the fact that digital currencies are a technology that promise to lower the cost and increase the efficiency of payments. And I think that has a lot of domestic applications, but it has huge cross-border applications. If you can make cross-border payments cheap and fast, then that currency becomes really valuable. And I think what China has done is started on the path toward that. And you could easily see the next step being cross-border transactions with major trading partners. And I think that does diminish the value of the US dollar in global trade.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Will 2021 be another good year for investors? Let's find out. Joining me on the program is Mish Schneider. She's managing director at Market Gauge. And Mish, let's talk about the cryptocurrencies. Let's begin there, especially Bitcoin.
So the actual instrument itself, as we know, went to record highs again today. And so the chart just looks like the very typical parabolic move that is a bull's dream. And yet what's so interesting about Bitcoin is it's gotten a lot of attention, but it's actually really relatively underinvested still at this point. There's only really 2% investors, which account for 95% of the ownership of Bitcoin, only 35 million investors across 100 countries. So when you think about that, it's kind of mind-boggling, but at the same time, it makes predictions like JP Morgan's at 146,000 look reasonable.
Even though you've got this parabolic rise, I can recall just several years ago when it went from 1,000 to 19, but then it crashed. Is there a risk when you have these parabolic moves as we're seeing now? And as you know, you mentioned 146, I've heard 100,000, I've heard, 200,000. So where does it stop?
Well, that's a really good question, because my teeth were cut on the commodities exchange floor well back in the day when inflation ran rampant in the late 70s, early 80s. And I got to see these parabolic moves in gold, silver, some of the soft commodities. And so you think it's never going to end, but of course, everything comes to an end. And what that end is relative, obviously, to the instrument and to the cycle in the economy, et cetera. When it comes to Bitcoin, essentially, we have so many opportunities here that were different than in 2017. First of all, we have legitimacy by the likes of Stanley Druckenmiller, for example, or Paul Tudor Jones. We have companies like MicroStrategy, MSTR, which basically is a business consulting firm that put all their cash into Bitcoin, and like Square, for example. And then you have PayPal, where you can buy through Bitcoin. So all of this, and then you have an IPO coming up, a Coinbase IPO coming up, which also will be interesting. And maybe that'll be the kibosh, who knows? Once it's more mainstream, maybe that's it, we don't know. The point is, and I know that you've been trading for a long time too, is you have to have risk management. And you have to have a point where you say that I've taken some profit along the way, which we have because we've been long GBTC, and a stopping point where you're willing to get out and have a fresh look.
So let's talk about another investment that, let's say, competes with cryptocurrencies. Let's talk about precious metals, and let's begin with gold.
Well, I'm a huge gold fan because it's something that I traded, as I was mentioning, way back in the day and saw what it can do. It's a very emotional, kind of like Bitcoin trade, in that when it gets going and you get the herd mentality behind it, it keeps going. However, as we know, what's right now, it's kind of fallen out of favor because they're looking at Bitcoin as the hedge against inflation, number one, where that would be gold's job typically. And number two, yesterday was a classic example when things were going down at the White House and it looked like all hell was breaking loose. It was Bitcoin that rallied on that and not gold. So there's a couple of differences between gold and Bitcoin. Obviously, the fact now that psychologically things have shifted, but also interest rate sensitive with yields have gone up yesterday. That also put a little bit of a sobering note on the gold market after it's been trying to take off. But I still think that gold, if there we have any kind of increased geopolitical strife, whether it be domestically or on the world stage, people will turn to gold. It's a hard asset. And as I mentioned, with such underinvestment still in Bitcoin, gold is what people feel comfortable with, especially millennial baby boomer generation in particular. The Robinhood traders just haven't caught wind of gold yet. And if they do, that could shift.
And let's talk about something that influences the markets and obviously even precious metals or who knows, even cryptocurrencies. Let's talk about where treasury yields are going. On the day you and I are doing this interview, you've got the 10-year finally crossing over 1%. Where do you think interest rates are heading? I hear talk that this year we may get 1.5% on the 10-year.
Well, we did have the Fed minutes come out yesterday, and they did intimate towards some kind of tapering, similar to what they did in 2013, 2014. So yeah, it's possible. I was actually almost pleasantly happy or surprised to hear the Fed have some sense of reality, because it seemed like they were completely with heads in sand looking at some of the other inflation indicators that aren't using the metrics, like, for example, food. which has skyrocketed. The commodities in wheat, soybeans, corn have just gone up 40% over the last 4 months. Even sugar, which is something that was going up even before the gold and silver did back in the 70s, has been rising. And other indicators, of course, like steel and copper. So it is possible that the interest rates could rise here. First of all, to have some protection so that inflation, which they were willing to let run hot over 2%, doesn't get out of control. And I'm starting to see more comments like that coming out of the Fed. However, they have to be super careful too, because we still have a fragile economy. Whether you're looking at the market on all new all-time highs versus the economy, which is still limping along, the Fed is really looking more at the economy than at the stock market, or supposedly anyway.
So let's talk about stocks now. If you take a look at the S&P last year, it was up about 16%. But Misha, if you back out the FANG stocks, I think the average was up roughly about 5 or 6% versus the 16. So you had five stocks that really accounted for the bulk of the S&P gain. Do you see that happening again, or do you see this rally broadening where maybe money shifts out of some of what I call the COVID growth areas like the Amazons and the tech stocks, and the market rally broadens?
Well, yes, we're already seeing that. One of the things that I have done over the years is created what I call an economic modern family. And because it gave me a way to really look at the macro and humanize the different sectors of the economy. And so the granddaddy of that family for me has been the Russell 2000. And the grandma of that family was retail. And then one of the grandkids was transportation. And or is transportation, I should say. And so for all these years that I've been in this situation now where you were running money and where we have services, et cetera, I've used it as a way to explain that, yes, we were seeing a tech rally and a FANG rally, but that the real economy, as measured by these inside sectors that really measure what I see in the U.S. economy, given Russell's are mainly manufacturing in the United States. Of course, transportation, going back to Charles Dow, is still a very legitimate index to look at. And then retail, based on a consumer economy, were lagging. That switched really starting in July. And so the economic modern family, if you will, has been leading. And I think it's a much healthier sign. I believe that it can sustain longer than a tech rally at this point. And it definitely is the reason why we're here right now in the market, because it's reflecting an optimism regardless of the doom and gloom.
Do you see any other sectors or parts of the economy changing as a result of COVID? So, you know, we're rolling out the vaccines right now. And the talk is at some point, I don't know if it's mid-year, that we're going to get back to normal, whatever that normal is going to look like. But there's obviously trends that have been accelerated. Mish, we hear talk about real estate that some employers are finding they don't need as much real estate to run their business. You take a look at, I was reading that Amazon last year hired something like 400,000 employees. They doubled their staff. So, you know, online, that's going to continue. Retail's going to be reshaped. What are you seeing there in terms of sectors that could be breaking out and continuing the pre-COVID trend?
Well, one of the things that I think we've started to see happen was some of these small growth cap stocks, these tech companies like Zebra and HubSpot, that came on the scene, VBK being the ETF that measures it. They came on the scene as the newer technology to make the stay at home and the businesses not being in commercial real estate easier to do. And that has really caught fire. In fact, if you compare those to the FANG stocks, they have well outperformed. If you're looking just at Microsoft, for example, or an NVIDIA or Amazon, not Apple, because that's on its own fumes, they've all relatively underperformed. So I think that those small cap tech stocks are pretty much here to stay. But in terms of other areas, yeah, I do believe that we will see a continuation in terms of more businesses working from home. But I also believe that we will see people starting to come out back to work and back into being with one another, because we're creatures that need to be around other people. So that's why Zoom is down while the market is making new highs today. But in terms of other things that are growing, one of the things that came out of the pandemic that was completely expected was, of course, the clean energy movement and the rise in stocks like TAN, for example, which is the solar ETF, and all the electric vehicles that have rocketed, along with companies like Ballard and Plug. You know, all of this area may have gotten a little ahead of itself, but those are the kinds of things you want to look at on corrections. Stuff that has been beaten up that I think could come back, some this year has already started, is like some of the media stocks. We've been long Viacom, AT&T is doing better. Even, believe it or not, World Wrestling has emerged from a base. It is considered to be a media stock. And then healthcare, that's what I have a keen eye on already. As soon as pretty much yesterday, when it was obvious that the Senate was going to go to a 50-50, we became buyers of Teladoc, and United Healthcare is not one we're in, but we had recommended. So I think that you'll see some things calm down, like the explosion that we saw in this classic technology stay at home, and Zoom being the clear winner of that. Yet technology and AI, why shouldn't that continue? That's the future. Technology in terms of alternative energy, that should continue. Electric cars should continue. Look at Tesla. Tesla traded up to 800 today. And then we're also looking at, like I said, more and maybe even infrastructure coming into play, provided we can see some kind of a bill passed in the first 100 days of the Biden administration on infrastructure.
And what about, you mentioned some of the green energy plays. Is there anything that really stands out outside of, let's say, clean energy with the Biden administration?
Well, what's so interesting about the clean energy space is that if you've noticed, the oil has done better, but it's not necessarily the classic crude oil play that we've been looking at. We've been actually trading more of the oil companies that are trying to change how they do business to take advantage of this. So by reducing carbon emissions, stopping oil and gas exploration, and getting more into the electricity distribution space, because as Elon Musk has said recently, the demand for electricity is going to double globally. And so, for example, British Petroleum had been totally beat up. Nextra was another stock that had been totally beat up. Valero, some of these companies, even XOP, which is an oil and gas exploration ETF, is rallying. Now, of course, some of this is just on the euphoria that's all around, but some of it, particularly when we're looking at British Petroleum, Dutch Shell, Nextra, these companies are actually trying to be forward thinking and put their money more towards the emerging trend and away from the classic oil and gas.
Misha, final question. We're at the beginning of the year. Investors are looking at their 401k programs, thinking of allocation. If you were to place money to work right now, where would you be looking?
Well, I would be, first of all, in terms of putting money to work, I just always like to do a disclaimer that we are not buy and hold passive investors. We use rules-based trading, whether it be in our quantitative models or in our discretionary trading. So the asset allocation that we've been looking at, you know, we've switched a lot into these small cap growth stocks, and I still think the opportunity is there. I think some of the classic retail stocks are already a little bit extended, but I would be looking on pullbacks for that. And again, I'd be looking more at the manufacturing sector, particularly now if we get some kind of infrastructure deal, stocks like Vulcan Materials, things like that. So I would try to spread my portfolio more into hopefully what happens, which is a rebuild of America. When I say that, I don't mean that politically. I mean that economically. I'd also, since they've been so beaten up, probably would be looking at maybe some of the transportation stocks that have to do with airlines and travel. And then again, I mentioned healthcare before. I would be looking at healthcare. And in terms of emerging markets, they really got ahead of themselves in the dollar, which got pounded, is coming back a little bit. And we may actually see a rally a little bit in the dollar. So we were looking at the inflation plays coming into this year, and I would still continue with that. But I would also be keeping my eye on the classic indicator of inflation, and that would be gold miners, which has been beaten up. And if that starts to move out of its base, I think that can also explode as well. And that would kind of be almost my hedge in case the Fed has to do something proactive, like let the rates go up a little bit.
All right. Well, listen, Mish, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so, please?
Well, first of all, we do have a website, marketgage.com, which has a lot of different information, including a bunch of free material that comes out weekly. My husband, Keith Schneider, who's the CEO, does a market outlook. And then we do a daily blog, me and Forrest, my assistant. But also Twitter is probably the best place because I'm there very active at Market Minute. If you have any questions, I answer them very promptly on Twitter.
All right. Well, Mish, thanks so much and have a safe, happy, prosperous new year.
Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today to get your retirement plan started. We can help to make sure you have the income you need to live the lifestyle you want, how to maximize government benefits from Social Security to Medicare, reduce taxes and plan for future inflation, or protect your assets with an estate plan. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Well, welcome everyone to this week's Big Picture. This is our first live show for 2021. We're going to be looking at the forecasts of some major strategists out there, many of which we speak with on our show. We're going to look at the range of different forecasts for the S&P 500, for the economy, and also some outside-the-box predictions by Byron Wien, Saxo Bank, on what could happen for this year. So, Jim, let's kick things off and talk about what are some of the predictions for the U.S. economy in 2021?
Well, it doesn't come as a surprise to anybody, Chris. Everybody is predicting a very good year for the economy. But if you look at the economic numbers, it's kind of like a second half story. And one of the reasons you get this second half story is when there's still a little bit of uncertainty, as there is now, the election uncertainty has been lifted. So Biden will become the 46th president of the United States. So the election uncertainty has gone away. What has not gone away is the COVID-19. We had 1,000 deaths in California this week. I forget what day it was, either Wednesday or Thursday. And in, for example, in LA, there's a person dying of COVID every 6 minutes. So what is uncertain is this first 6 months. So if you look at the economic forecast, we were down, the economy contracted roughly about 3.5% for 2020. We haven't got all the final numbers, but that's what it's looking like right now. What they're predicting for 2021 is a 3.9% growth rate in the economy. A lot of that's going to be coming from private investment and consumer spending. And so they're almost... you know, we've always tried to get this 4% growth rate. Obama tried it, never happened. Trump tried it, never happened. So this 4% growth rate is what they're predicting, a strong bounce back. But Chris, a caveat to that, it's going to take place in the second half of the year. And I think a lot of that is predicated on what the government is going to do with the stimulus package. Now that the Democrats control Congress, remember when they were talking about a stimulus package and especially a big bailout of the states, last year they were talking about a $4 trillion package that couldn't get through a Republican Congress. Now that the Democrats control all branches of government, anticipating the stimulus package is going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $3 to $4 trillion. But obviously, when you put together a stimulus package outside of getting checks into people's hands, which is what they did last year, the bigger picture type things like infrastructure, those are things that are going to take time. But a good year for the economy, let's call it 4%, but the bulk of that is going to come in the second half. And that once again, when you're uncertain about something, you think it's going to be a good year, you kind of postpone it and say, well, we think we're going to have a good year for the economy, but it's going to be in the second half of the year.
Yeah. And again, the big caveat to that is, of course, what we see with COVID. Most of the attention now on that new variant called B117 that is supposedly much more contagious. So we'll have to see whether or not that is true. That's going to be something we're going to discuss a little bit more in depth next week on FS Insider with Jim Rickards. But that said, you know, so far, we have seen the data continue to recover. Stock market's at all-time record highs. So it looks like everything's going well so far. We'll have to see how things play out. But the leading economic indicators are still pointing up.
I mean, if you take a look at, they're predicting industrial production will be up by 4%. And another sector that remains strong throughout 2020 has been the housing sector. I mean, there's just not enough inventory. We're working with a client that's getting ready to retire, and I was helping her negotiate the purchase of a house in Arizona. And, you know, I grew up in Arizona. It's just surprising to see, Chris, you know, a lot of Californians are going to Arizona, so they're driving up the real estate market in Arizona. But I was just floored at some of these prices. They're anticipating another good 5 to 6% increase in housing prices this year. And it's anticipated that the unemployment rate will drop. It's at around 6.7 now. They're predicting it's going to get down to 6%. This year, we'll get to our own forecast, which we'll do next week. I want to talk about this 6% unemployment rate because a lot is going to depend on what the government does, what the fiscal policies are coming forward. Hourly earnings are expected to drop from in 2020. Hourly earnings were up probably one of the best years under Trump, 4.4%. That's expected to drop to down to little over 1%, 1.8%. Here's the big one, and we don't know what this is going to be like, and we don't know what the bond market's going to be like, but they are predicting the budget deficit for the government's fiscal year 2021. Remember, the government's fiscal year ends in September, and they're predicting the budget deficit is 9.9% of GDP. So I suspect what's going into that number, Chris, is that the Biden administration, now that they control Congress, will go forward with a $4 trillion stimulus package, $2 trillion in handouts and bailouts, and maybe $2 trillion in infrastructure. So that's why they're predicting a big budget deficit. Now, remember, for 2020, the budget deficit was $3.1 trillion, and that included 6 months of a strong economy. So we really didn't start seeing the effects of COVID until we got to March of last year. And you had about 6 months of the impact of COVID on the government's budget and also on economic activity. But even despite that, the budget deficit was $3.1 trillion. They're saying this year the budget deficit could be anywhere from $4 or $5 or $6 trillion, depending on how big of a stimulus package that comes out of the Biden administration. And we'll talk about that as we get to some of the things about investing for 2021.
So, Jim, so far, as you said, you know, when you look at the consensus forecast, it's 3.9% GDP growth for 2021, just under 4%. 2022 consensus forecast is at just over 3.1%. And then if we look at some of the figures for housing, housing still expected to be fairly strong, not as strong as it was in 2020, but not negative growth, still positive growth, maybe around 4%, 4 or 5%. And then unemployment still expected to be falling, higher budget deficits, just under 10%. And a lot of that will depend, like you said, on Democratic spending. So what are some of the drivers here for GDP this year, according to the consensus?
Let me just get to one more point, Chris, on the forecast, and that is interest rates, because, you know, we talked about housing starts, housing market, whether it's housing starts, new home sales, existing home sales, building permits, all rising. And one of the reasons is what we've seen with interest rates. We've, you know, I would have never, ever thought when I started out my career, when 10-year treasuries were at 15.5%, I would see the day that we would see mortgage rates at 2.5%. So this year, the consensus of forecast is that interest rates will begin to rise. The consensus will be 1.25% on the 10-year. We did cross the 1% level this year for the 10-year Treasury note. That just happened this week, and so that's important. But what are expected to be the drivers? How are we going to get to this 4% growth rate that they're talking about? Part of it gets right down to COVID-19, and that is the vaccine, and hopefully rolling that out and getting enough vaccines out there that we can get COVID-19 under control. And hopefully by summer, we will be approaching whatever the new normal is going to be like coming out of this pandemic. And so that's why, Chris, when you even look at some of the economic forecasts, they're saying we're without stimulus because of politics, they couldn't get a stimulus bill done on time to get it out in the economy. And we are seeing some softening of the economic numbers that'll probably take place in the first quarter of 2021. It's anticipated that that will begin to improve beginning in the second quarter, especially as the Biden administration rolls out its stimulus package, whatever that's going to look like. And then, of course, conditional on that is that we'll have enough vaccines that will begin to open up the economy and approach somewhat normal. Maybe we still wear masks, but they're not closing down restaurants, shutting down bars, gyms, and things of that nature. So the vaccine. The other aspect that has been positive because of all the lockdowns, because of the government transfer payments, the savings rate, I think it was the second quarter, got as high as 30%. It's roughly about 12% right now. So economists are saying, look, if you can't go anywhere, if you're locked down to your, you know, stand in your house or maybe just a trip to Costco, you're not spending money. So the savings rate is up. So the idea is there's plenty of firepower that consumers have to spend money with, as the economy begins to normalize and these lockdowns go away, especially in some of these heavily blue states where the governors have just been ruthless with the lockdowns. In fact, this last week, they had the police actually show up at somebody's house because they had six people and they arrested them. So, I mean, it's just crazy. But anyway, consumer spending has room to fuel this economy. And then don't forget, monetary stimulus. The Fed is buying about $120 billion of bonds a month. So the Fed is expected to exert pressure on the yield curve. And then, once again, the economic stimulus, it is anticipated when it comes out, it is going to be huge. Because remember, Pelosi's budget, with her plan, it was around $4 trillion. Now, the Republicans didn't go along with it because it was bailouts for states like California, New York, that have been mismanaged. But anyway, if we see a $3 to $4 trillion stimulus package, and you've got $120 billion a month coming from the Fed, so there's about a trillion and a half monetary stimulus and a $4 trillion fiscal stimulus. It's no wonder they're talking about 4% growth rates, and we haven't even gotten to what some people are thinking is going to happen to the stock market. I know if you're listening to this, you're thinking, "Gosh, stocks are higher. How can they go any higher?" Well, when you've suppressed something, as that was the case in 2020, and we're still doing it right now. I mean, California is in lockdown mode, and other states are as well. When you suppress that activity and then you lift whatever was suppressing it, then you're going to have this pent-up demand. So that is kind of what the thinking is. The catalysts are going to be the vaccine, consumer spending, and then just massive, and I talk massive, monetary and fiscal stimulus.
Okay, Jim, so that is the economy, again, housing, budget deficits, the drivers that a lot of people are looking at, pent-up demand, plenty of stimulus on the sidelines now that we have a blue wave, expectation for further economic stimulus. There's nothing really holding Democrats back from getting to those larger stimulus stimulus amounts that they were hoping for originally. What about the stock market? What does the consensus expect when it comes to the S&P 500?
Another great year for the stock market, Chris. The predictions for the S&P this year go anywhere on the low side from a 7.5% increase to, on the high side, a 17% increase. And we're going to get into some of these numbers. And right now, the average increase for the S&P, the average is the S&P will close out the year at 4,035. That's roughly about a 7.5% gain. The median is 4,000. That would be 6.5. The high, believe it or not, is 4,400, which would be a 17% gain. So I know a lot of you are thinking, oh my goodness, we're getting into a bubble. But here's something you have to look at in perspective. Last year, the S&P was up around 16%, but the bulk of that gain came in just five stocks, the FANG stocks. You know, your Facebook, your Amazon, your Apple, Microsoft, Netflix, those type of stocks. If you back them out, the S&P was only up about 6% last year. What they're expecting this year is a broader movement within the stock market. So as fund managers take a look at value is expected to do better this year than growth, and also the rest of the economy. Last year was kind of like what I call the COVID stocks. It was the FANG stocks, your tech stocks, your COVID beneficiaries, think Peloton, think Zoom, think of all these type of companies. This year, the stock market gains are expected to broaden, and some of those stocks. And also, as the dollar goes down, remember, about 70% of, or a little over 50% of the sales of these S&P 500 companies come from overseas. So as the dollar goes down, if you're a company like Coca-Cola, you get 70% of your sales from overseas, dollar goes down, you translate, you know, maybe you're getting paid in euros or you're getting paid in yen or renminbi, they translate into higher profits when they're translated into U.S. dollars. So that's why even the consensus estimates for the S&P this year go from $170 all the way up to $194 on the high side. So another good year for stocks, but it's going to be a different kind of market. What's interesting is we're going to have Craig Johnson, who still maintains his bullseye target, his title. He nailed it once again for 2020. He was talking about 3,600. He was only off just slightly, but he was the most positive in terms of the forecast for 2020. And remember, a lot of people didn't think the stock market was going to do what it did. But I mean, quite honestly, that's mainly a handful of six stocks that accounted for most of the gains. But Bullseye Craig Johnson, his forecast for the S&P this year is 4,225. And the highest forecast is coming from J.P. Morgan and Cantor Fitzgerald. They see an S&P 500 at 4,400. So Craig is... You know, normally you always see Craig at the top. He's been the most bullish. He's still in that very, very bullish camp, expecting another good year for the market. And that would be somewhere in the neighborhood of a 15% gain. So, Chris, on the low side, you have a 7% gain. On the high side, it goes all the way up to 17%. So nobody is anticipating a negative market this year. And so... Although some people think that, you know, when you, the consensus is on one side of the boat, sometimes you can have some big surprises. I mean, take a look at the way we started 2020. I mean, all of 2020, if you think about it, was one big surprise. You started out the year, lowest unemployment rate in history, best running economy. Everything was running, and then all of a sudden COVID hit, changed everything. So, you know, but anyway, once again, this is the consensus. Good year for the economy, 4% growth rate. and another good year for the stock market, anywhere from 7% to 8% all the way up to 17% gains.
Well, now it's time to look at the outside-the-box predictions, and we're going to first look at what Byron Wien is saying for his top 2021 surprises. Here's a clip of what he recently said on CNBC.
There are three that are really surprises. The China surprise, having a favorable relationship with China, that's certainly one. The Justice Department pulling back on trying to break up Google and Facebook, that would be a big surprise. And the dollar being strong rather than weak would be a big surprise.
That's true.
So that was Byron Wien. And Jim, it's interesting. This year, I noticed he's been doing this for a very long time, decades, talking about his various surprises each year. But this year is something different. It's, it sounds like he's now been joined by Vice Chairman at Blackstone, Joe Zittel.
Yeah. And, you know, Byron's getting up there. And just to give you a little bit of color on this, Byron Wien has been doing his 10 surprises. 2021 marks his 36th year that he's done this. He started it in 1986 when he was a chief investment strategist at Morgan Stanley. Byron joined the Blackstone Group in 2009. And I suspect bringing Zittel in, maybe they're saying, you know, Byron's getting up there, so maybe we'll introduce somebody younger. But nonetheless, there were two of them this year. So normally what we like to do when you look at these outside-the-box forecasts, we take a look at how well did you do in the previous year with your forecast. But given what happened to 2020, I don't think you can hold anybody's forecast and take a look at it and say, boy, you really missed a lot of these. Well, no kidding, given what happened in 2020. So I'm just going to get to what they're predicting for 2021. Some of these are unusual. Some of them sound a little bit more conventional. Number one, his prediction, former President Trump starts his own television network and also plans his 2024 campaign. That'd be interesting because Trump would be 78 in 2024, about where Biden is now. His lead program is called The Chief, in which he weekly interviews heads of state and CEOs with management styles like his own. His virtual interview with Vladimir Putin draws more viewers than any television program in history. So that's number one. Number two, despite the hostile rhetoric from both sides during the presidential campaign, President Biden begins to restore a constructive diplomatic in trade relationship with China. China A shares lead emerging markets higher. Number three, the success of between 5 and 10 vaccines, together with an improvement in therapeutics, allows the U.S. to return to some form of normal by Memorial Day 2021. Let me just break in here. Once again, that gets to Chris, the forecast that we're seeing, the consensus forecast. Almost a 4% growth rate, but it's a second half story of 2021. And that's what Byron Wien is saying here. People are generally required to show proof of vaccination before boarding airplanes and attending theaters. I saw a call by the airlines for that this week, and also attending sporting events or movie theaters. The Summer Olympics, postponed last year, will be held in July, with spectators allowed to physically attend. Number four, the Justice Department softens its case against Google and Facebook, persuaded by the argument that consumers actually benefit from the service provided by these monopoly companies. Number five, the economy develops momentum on its own because of pent-up demand, and depressed hospitality and airline stocks become strong performers. Fiscal and monetary policy remain historically accommodative, and economic growth exceeds 6%. There's that nominal number we talked about. The unemployment rate falls to 5, and we begin the longest economic cycle in history. A lot of positive stuff coming here. Number six, the Federal Reserve and the Treasury openly embrace MMT as their accommodative policies continue. as long as growth exceeds the rate of inflation, deficits don't seem to matter. Gold rallies and cryptocurrencies gain more respect during the year. Number 7 prediction, energy company executives cut estimates for long-term growth. Near-term opportunities are increasing. The return to normal increases both industrial activity and mobility, and the price of West Texas Intermediate crude rises to $65 a barrel. Energy stocks are among the best performers in 2021. Number 8, the equity market broadens out. Stocks beyond healthcare and technology participate. Risk on is not without risk, and the market corrects almost 20% in the first half. But the S&P 500, oh my goodness, closes at 4,500 in the year, which would imply a 20% gain for the market. Cyclicals lead defensive, small caps beat large, and the K-shaped equity market recovery unwinds. Big cap tech is the source of liquidity, and stocks are laggards for the year. Number 9, the surge in economic growth rates drives treasury yields to 2%. The consensus forecast is roughly about 1.25, which I think, in personal opinion, I think is too low. We'll be getting there pretty soon. Like I said, this week we already crossed the 1% level. Number 10, the slide in the dollar turns around. The post-vaccine strength of the U.S. economy and financial markets attracts investors disenchanted with the rising debt and slower growth rates of Europe and Japan. So once again, Byron Wayne's outside the box forecast. A lot of this was traditional. There are a few things, on politics that, you know, who knows which way this is going to go. But everybody is anticipating, Chris, massive, and I mean massive, fiscal stimulus. We're going to see the biggest budget deficits in U.S. history. And the question is, will modern monetary theory hold up if inflation rears its ugly head? We'll talk more about that in our own forecast next week.
The overall title of the outrageous prediction for 21 is The Future Is Now. We think what the pandemic has done, and which is not fully priced into the market, is move the agenda from one of financial stability to social stability. The social stability has embedded into it three major components, which is, of course, inequality. It is green transformation and it's infrastructure. And that, again, into the context of a constrained physical capital structure we have in the world right now, means that the interest rate sensitive sectors around the world would be very, very hard hits. In other words, what has been doing extremely well during a period of worsening economic condition will be replaced by shorts in those markets. I also think we have to tip our hats for the fact that inside the space of 1 year, I think it was almost exactly 1 year ago, we had the first cases in China. And now 1 year later, we have something that looks like a very efficient vaccine. I don't think the market is even fully pricing that. And I think what we're trying to do in this year's crops of outrageous prediction is to say, listen, we moved in 2020, we moved the agenda, the needle, economically, politically, socially, almost 10 years in 1 year. But the one upside was that science came through. And a lot of the calls we have this year is about science coming through in energy, in vaccine becoming. So for me, both as an outrageous call, but also as my practical call, I think the economy is going to have a much, much better year in 21 than we actually are forecasting right now. And particularly, much, much better than the narrative that the central banks are giving us.
So that was a clip of Steen Jacobsen, chief economist and CEO at Saxo Bank. They give their 10 outlandish or outrageous forecasts each year. So those are the ones that they're making for 2021.
This is from Steen. He goes, for the 2021 batch of outrageous predictions, we decided for the most part to don our futurist caps rather than getting too bogged down in market trends and central bank policies. That is largely because COVID-19 pandemic and the painful U.S. election cycle have brought what might have seemed a distant future a quantum leap closer, accelerating, and this is a theme that we've been talking about on the program last year, accelerating nearly every underlying social and technological supertrend. Simply put, the traumas of 2020 mean that in 2021, the future is now. And then they go on here, and this is what you see in the evening news. It's no secret. He goes, in 2020, we fretted about the world becoming ever more fragmented with a biased media and social media algorithms driving everyone to the extremes and towards living in parallel realities. Even ability to agree on the basic facts seems under threat. This year's set of 2021 outrageous predictions generally expresses the hope that these tendencies will reverse, believing that the social mood is cyclical and we can learn from our mistakes. While technological evolution is progressive in nature and always marching forward in the background. So basically what they're basically saying here, the trends that were already in place prior to the pandemic, you know, we talked about online shopping as one trend, technology, AI, automation, and blockchain are disrupting everything from whole categories of jobs to the very structure of our society and its assumptions about what constitutes capitalism. So, here we go. Prediction number one, Amazon buys the island of Cyprus. As European banks or governments go after the big tech companies for dodging taxes, Amazon redirects its European domicile to Cyprus. However, they want to mimic Ireland's tax jurisdiction with the country's leaders and its population. However, it backfires on Amazon. Number two, the debt in France gets so bad that Germany has to bail out France because France's debt to GDP ratio is 140%. Might want to think about that if you own foreign government bonds. Number three, blockchain tech kills fake news. The algorithms that favor engagement, funneling readers to extreme attention-grabbing positions on blogs and biased news media outfits. Basically, tackling this trend, companies like Verizon and IBM are developing technologies to counter fake news with verification using blockchain network. Number four, China's new digital currency inspires tectonic shifts in capital flows. Number five, this is interesting. Revolutionary fusion design catapults humanity into energy abundance. And, this has been, we're going to do a show on this in the next couple of weeks. But this green stuff they're talking about, solar and wind, it doesn't work. It's energy inefficient. So they're saying fusion market opens up the prospect of a world no longer held back by water or food scarcity, thanks to desalination and vertical farming. Number six, universal basic income decimates big cities. Commercial office properties are crushed, along with commercial real estate containing restaurants and shops aimed at servicing commuting workers with drones. Number seven, disruption dividend creates a citizens technology fund. Basically, this is created to transfer a portion of asset ownership of capital assets to everyone. So how are you going to do that? Probably it would have to take place with central banks going in and buying assets, kind of like the Bank of Japan buys stocks. And number eight, a successful COVID-19 vaccine kills companies. The Fed ends up making a policy mistake by allowing financial conditions to tighten too rapidly via higher long-term interest rates. And this is something that we're going to talk about next week. One of the, in fact, we'll talk about it in just a couple minutes, is MMT works until you have inflation. If inflation stays around 2%, and already the Fed has indicated that they're willing to let it go past that to make up for the disinflation we've seen, that basically inflation comes back stronger than what people are anticipated. And number nine, sun shines on silver, which sizzles on solar panel demand. Now, one of the things that we're very big on with our company, we're big on the raw materials of green energy. What are they? Nickel, copper, silver. You need silver for solar panels, and that's what they're saying here. In fact, a real silver crunch is on the cards for 2021. It frustrates the full-throttle political support for solar energy investments under a Biden presidency, the European Green Deal, and China's 2060 carbon neutral goal, among other initiatives. And finally, number 10, next generation tech supercharges frontier and emerging markets. And so they're very long emerging markets, as some of the strategists are for 2021. So, you know, not as outrageous as they normally have. And that's basically, I think, Chris, they're saying that a lot of the stuff that happened as a result of the pandemic have changed everything. So once again, you know, it'd be difficult and probably unfair to go to the predictions, whether it was Byron Wien or even any other forecasters. When you take a look at what happened in 2021, who would have thought in January 1 of 2019 we would have seen what we did with COVID-19 shutting down? I mean, at least my lifetime, Chris, I've never seen anything like that, where you shut down the economy the way we've done that.
Yeah, unprecedented, that's for sure. You know, one of the interesting things that we've been discussing on our podcast, we started really getting into this in 2019, was how the 2020s could see a repeat of the Roaring Twenties. This is something that Dr. Nicholas Christakis has discussed in his book, Apollo's Arrow, is that we tend to see historically, after a major global pandemic, there is all that pent-up demand. There's also a lot of pent-up people wanting social interactions because they're isolated for a long time. After the economy opens up, people tend to go crazy. And this is something that he's documented that we see over the past, you know, 100 or 200 years with different global pandemics around the world. So that's what we saw with the Roaring Twenties after the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. And he's predicting that we're going to see that again once the economy opens up and the vaccines get rolled out. So a very interesting scenario to consider. So Jim, with all of that that we've discussed so far in terms of consensus forecasts and the outside the box forecasts, both from Saxo Bank and Byron Wien, what could go wrong this year?
You know, at the top of the list, it's no surprise, it's politics. We have a new administration that is, you know, promising radical changes to government. Political risk here could be that political turmoil, the Democrats pushed their agenda too far. They got three things that they're saying they want to do. Number one, pack the Supreme Court. So basically, President Trump appointed three conservatives. They would appoint maybe five or six activist judges. So Supreme Court. Number two, get rid of the Electoral College. And number three, make D.C., Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico statehood. Now, that may sound crazy to you, but on Thursday, as a result of the protest, the mayor of Washington, D.C. said the first thing she is going to ask the Biden administration the first week in office is to make Washington, D.C. a 51st state in the country. And what that would do is they would get two Democratic senators from Washington, D.C., and then they would make Puerto Rico the 52nd state. So that would give them four senators, Democratic senators. So, you know, it's just like in the Obama administration, when they controlled all branches of government, they pushed Obamacare, not one Republican vote. Now they control the Senate with the Vice President Kamala Harris can pass the deciding vote. And one of the things that Schumer's talked about is getting rid of the filibuster so they could just ram these bills through. So if they push this through, Chris, there's a real risk they could lose the House or lose Congress in 2022 unless they control the voting machines like they did in this election. So there's political risk, number one. Number two is COVID pandemic, the vaccines. They're having trouble rolling them out in California and New York, that the vaccine rollout is slower. And obviously, if you want to get COVID-19 under control, get rid of the lockdowns, then you've got to gain control over this virus. I mean, right now here in California, this is probably this past week, the worst week that we've had since the pandemic broke out. I think it was, what was it, Chris? What, Tuesday or Wednesday, 1,000 people died. And there was a report out in Los Angeles. There's person dying of COVID every 6 minutes. So COVID, slow rollout on the vaccine, or it mutates in even to a more deadly virus. That's number two. Number three, U.S.-China relations. It hasn't gone well with Trump. Will the Bidens restore? They have an economic benefit relationship with China, so that's a risk. Number four, fiscal and monetary policy. What if the market reacts to sort of all pork spending, doesn't like what it sees in the budget, and the bond vigilantes show up and interest rates start to rise? That is something that could be a game changer for Washington. The other thing that we're seeing a lot of, Chris, is, as you discussed on FS Insider this week, cyber security. We saw last year where they hacked into government websites. And then also another risk, you know, everybody's talking about 4% growth rate, but it's going to take place in the second half of the year, hopefully with the vaccines out. Well, what if these blue state governors and mayors keep their states in lockdown? The U.S. could be in a recession. And of course, a recession would not be good for the market. And then number seven, you know, you got to throw this out there. It's always geopolitical risk. There's always something out there, Korea, the Middle East, or something you do not expect, but you can't predict. 9/11 wasn't predictable. A lot of the stuff that happens geopolitically are not predictable. So, Chris, those are just some of the obvious things that could go wrong.
All right, Jim. So those are all the things that could go wrong. And of course, you know, if we think about 2020, Craig Johnson, again, bullseye Craig Johnson was right on the mark with his forecast for being the most bullish on the stock market. A lot of people are pushing back against that. Then again, we did see this major crash. It looked like he was going to be wrong. In the end, he ended up being the most correct in his forecast for a 3,600 target. We hit 3,700. So things can unfold in ways that you don't expect. So put all this together for us, Jim, and let's talk about some of the investment implications.
Yeah, and one of the biggest mistakes here is, you know, there's always worries for the market, and worries about COVID, worries about the economy, worries about interest rates, worries about unemployment, all these kind of things. And one of the best things that you can take a look at is, do not let your political beliefs or views color your investment judgments. And that, you know, there are a lot of people that aren't for Biden. I mean, 74 million voted for President Trump. And if you voted for President Trump, you can't let that political view color your investment judgments. So that's why, you know, if you take a look at the last 10 years, we had the pig crisis in 2011. We had the hiccup of getting away from taper in 2013. We had China problems in 2015. So all along, we've had these pullbacks, Chris, and everybody said, you know, get out of stocks, or the Fed's printing money, get out of the stock market. Well, if there's one thing that we can say right now, for income investors, there's no better place than the stock market. That's where the yields are. The first time in my career, the dividend yield is actually higher than what you can get in the bond market. We are not favorably disposed to bonds here. And one of the reasons, Chris, is if you take a look globally, almost 80% of all investment grade bonds have a yield of 1% or less. And so the better yields for income investors, like it or not, are in the stock market. And let's start with a venerable investment philosophy, and that's called Dogs of the Dow, where you buy the highest 10 highest dividend yielding stocks at the beginning of each year. Let's take a look at, for 2021, the Dogs of the Dow. At the top of the list are Chevron, with a dividend yield of 6.1%. A lot of people would have thought Exxon, but Exxon and Pfizer were removed from the Dow last year. And the number two spot is IBM, with a dividend yield of 5.2. Number three is Dow Chemical with a yield of almost 5.1%. Number four, Walgreens with a dividend yield of 4.7%. Number five, Verizon at a dividend yield of 4.27. 3M, number six, at a dividend yield of 3.36. Cisco, never thought you'd see these tech stocks in the dogs of the Dow, but Cisco with a dividend yield of 3.2. Merck, a dividend with roughly about 3.2. Amgen, a dividend yield of almost 3.1. And Coca-Cola with a dividend yield of almost 3%. So those are the dogs of the Dow. So if you're an income investor, Chris, you're going to have to go to the stock market. But I think what you're seeing with most strategists are saying, you know, the COVID stocks like your Pelotons, your Zooms, your Fangs dominated the market in 2019 and they accounted for, you know, like I said, six stocks accounted for the bulk of the gain in the S&P 500. So this year they're saying value stocks, other sectors of the economy, as the economy goes into that recovery, should lead. Energy is predicted to be a big winner. Financial stocks like banks as interest rates rise. And what that means, if you're a bond investor, if interest rates start rising, that means the value of your bond fund is going to go down. You will have a negative rate of return. So if you are bonds, you might want to think of a laddered bond portfolio where you aren't subject to the risk of being in a fund or ETF. The other big thing is a prediction of emerging markets. As the dollar falls, as it is doing now, that is leading to rising emerging markets. It's predicted they should outperform the U.S. Not everybody agrees with that. At the top, Goldman Sachs, their strategy is basically stay long the U.S., stay long stocks, and the U.S. has been the gap between the economic outperformance of the U.S. and the rest of the world keeps widening, just as the wealth gap between the wealthy and the not wealthy is widening. Well, the performance gap on the economic front in the between the U.S. and the top G20 countries is widening. So, you know, stay the U.S. And finally, Chris, commodities, because, you know, there are a number of reasons, and we're going to get into this when we get into our own forecast next week, where I'm going to make a case for an energy crisis and a decade-long bull market in commodities. And I don't care if you're looking at precious metals, looking at copper, silver, lead, zinc, oil, it's going to be a decade of commodities, kind of like the OO decade. But that's it's going to be a different world, Chris. You know, it's like Saxo Bank. They said basically, you know, all these trends that were developing prior to the pandemic have now accelerated. And just as Saxo Bank says, the future is now. And it's a different world that we're going to be investing for the remainder of this decade.
Well, as always, if any of you want to get in touch with any of our advisors to speak about financial planning services, money management, managing corporate cash balances, or even the services that we provide for 401ks, you can give our advisors a call at 888, that's 888-486-3939.
Well, that concludes this week's Forecast 2021. This was the consensus view on the markets, the economy. We will be back next week with Forecast 2021 with our own views as I make the case for an energy shock and a roaring bull market in commodities the remainder of this decade. But the theme will be conflict and turmoil, not just for 2021, but for the balance of this decade. That's coming up next week. In the meantime, we'd like to wish you a happy, prosperous, safe, and healthy new year. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.